you're thinking about partnerships and looking at them, the intent matters. What is your intention with this partnership? And what I mean, and a great example, there's a chapter in our book that where we talk about the difference between transactional interactions and transformational interactions. And you know, if you're coming in and you're thinking, I need to partner up with somebody so that I can do this or so that I can grow my business for that, and you're thinking of it very transactionally, like I'm gonna give them this, they're gonna give me a little bit more, and I'm gonna come out ahead. You know, that generally is not the way to approach a partnership of any kind.
Welcome to Partnership Plus, your go-to source for modern partnership wisdom with your host, Phil Hayes St. Clair.
Hey, it's Phil, and in this episode of Partnership Plus, we have the great pleasure to speak with Garrett Brown and Colin Coggins, who are the authors of The Unsold Mindset. We are going to be talking about sales and business development in the context of both business partnerships, but also when you're having business partners in the same business. We're talking about how you show up authentically, how you deal with failure, how you create a way to sell so authentically that people just want to deal and do business with you. You're going to love this conversation. So without further ado, let's speak with Garrett Brown and Colin Coggins. Colin and Garrett, two guys who I have a huge amount of admiration for. We finally get a chance to talk, and we're talking about sales and mindsets and partnerships and all of the pieces that these guys know better than probably anyone in the world. Guys, such a pleasure to have you here today.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
We are going to dive into a lot about your book, a lot about the mindset, the teaching that you both do, and you're quite a dynamic duo. So I'm very keen to dive into all the content that we can teach people, particularly leaders who might be a little bit, I guess, frightened or reluctant to be salespeople. And we all obviously are salespeople. So I'm very keen to get as much learning from you that we can pass on to folks. But before we get to that, let's get to the backstory, because from the research we've done, it looks like you both come from some pretty interesting backgrounds. So Colin, do you want to kick us off with where you've come from?
Yeah. Where do I come from? Jeez. I have historically been a salesperson that hated being a salesperson fresh out of college and got put on a PIP and was going to get fired into a really good salesperson by metrics, not by ego. Sales manager, director, trainer, and then all the way up, chief revenue officer, chief commercial officer, and then eventually where we are now, author, professor, best friend of this guy, keynote speaker. So listen, I think what you're asking is where did I come from that's interesting? I came from a place where I really hated sales. That's the answer. I was raised to go to college to get a real job, not to be in sales. And when I first was hired for a sales job, because that was the only job I could get out of college, I was really bad at it. And I was really clear that it was okay I was bad at it, because I stood on higher moral ground. I was smarter. I was more educated. I was younger. Any excuse, like in terms of blame displacement. But I was bad. And at 21, I got put on a PIP. And they were like, hey, this is your first job and you're going to get fired from it. You're really bad at sales. This isn't for you. And that was the day that I realized I might as well screw this establishment over on my way out. And so I started abiding by the dress code. I stopped asking questions I didn't want to know the answers to. I stopped reading scripts. I stopped laughing at jokes that weren't funny. And that was the month that I accidentally broke the sales record.
How interesting. I feel like I have a very similar story, but before I get to any close to that, Garrett, how did you meet this guy, and what is your backstory to bring you to a point where you're
my backstory is not nearly as interesting as Colin's. I think what especially for a partnership podcast, I think what's interesting about us is that we both came from sort of different angles into the sales world. Neither one of us wanted to be salespeople, as Colin just told you. I actually was a lawyer before I got into the startup sales game. But eventually we got to a point where we came together and met at a company that was called Bidium, and it was an enterprise software company here in Los Angeles. And, you know, I was the chief revenue officer at the time, and I was in a little bit over my head as we started to scale really quickly. And Colin walked in the room as kind of the expert and the guiding force that I didn't know I needed at that point. And like he mentioned, we just instantly kind of became best friends. We helped grow that company, sold that company to Google a few years back. And that was obviously a big moment professionally, but also people started to want to know how we did it, because we did it literally in a garage in Santa Monica, like the stereotypical startup story. And so as that was sold and I went on to Google and Colin went on to do some other interesting things, we stayed together and we started talking to classrooms about it as guest lecturers. We started talking at conferences and to companies, and we realized that the message that we had was something that was resonating with people, because it wasn't the typical sales, like the typical startup sales message. It was more about mindset and how you think about the things you're doing instead of just the things that you're doing. And so we found ourselves in front of all those people. And eventually that became our class at USC, Sales Mindset for Entrepreneurs, which we've been teaching for 13 semesters now and is still a core of what we do. And we started, you know, more professionally doing keynotes and workshops for companies and organizations. And then the publishing world came calling. And when we got a publishing deal with HarperCollins to publish our book, The Unsold Mindset, that was sort of for us an opportunity to take this message and really spread it, not just to the people that we could get in front of, but to everybody.
Phil, sorry, can I just say one thing? Like, I said this was my best friend when I gave my intro, but like just because this is a perfect example. This is a partnership podcast, and I'm literally not talking about partnership at all. And I can always count on my partner to think about things that I am nowhere even close to. And so I'm sure you're going to talk a lot about, we'll talk a lot about partnership, but like that is such a prime example. You see how he just like slyly was like, since this is a partnership podcast, Colin,
Colin.
I'm just calling out my yang to my yin as we start to embark on actually what this podcast is about. And that was just a great example that I wanted to call.
I mean, this is the perfect yin and yang. This is exactly what we're here to talk about. So, you know, you both mentioned before the idea of not being a salesperson, right? Let's just dive into that a little bit, because there are so many people that have this very quick visceral reaction when they think of a used car salesman, slimy techniques, really poor scripts, you know, really sort of hard selling. And in your book, you talk about this idea that, you know, people are just trying to help you. The best salespeople, you'll never, ever know that they're selling to you. What was it about that first starting point? And, you know, Colin, for you, when you were in that first role, you just didn't believe you were a salesperson. Was it because when you walked in the room, the archetype of a salesperson just was something that you just went, nut, this is not me? Or was it something different about that first starting experience?
It's you, when you initially asked the question, you said we, and then you took it back and you were like, I mean, you, about the book. But we wrote the book, and the biggest surprise about the book was that we weren't teaching people how to do something. Every time, like, our heart flutters a little bit when we get one of these reviews that like makes us feel like we're living in our purpose. Mm-hmm. It's when someone says, I never knew why I was good until I read your book. So like, I love that you said we, because you probably, that means there's some element where you saw yourself in it. And that's sort of the answer to the question is, we were, you know, my foray into sales, like I didn't, it didn't crack. There was no unlock until I stopped showing up as the salesperson they expected me to be.
Right.
And when I showed up as the human being, then they treated me like a human being. When I showed up as the salesperson, they treated me like a salesperson. And, you know, people tend to look for the good in you if they have a reason to. Right. And so, you know, that authentic self, that vulnerable self, like all you're really doing is just getting to this imperfect moment as quick as possible to show them that it doesn't matter if we look alike or not. Like, we have a lot more in common. Look, I'm imperfect. And then it's like, oh, I like, if I'm seeing myself in you, I'm looking for the good in you. I'm looking for reasons to believe in you. The greatest salespeople on the planet, as we embarked on this journey and we were hiring and we were growing our team, and then we were writing the book and doing interviews, greatest salespeople were the opposite of who people thought they were.
Right.
They weren't the most gregarious. They weren't the most self-confident. They weren't the most extroverted. They were the most self-aware people in the room. They knew they said something. It did not land. They were able to change immediately. Mm. They're having a conversation with somebody. They knew that person did not think that they were listening. They thought they were waiting to speak. They were able to move. Right. They're, like, these shifts that Garrett said earlier, like, it wasn't what they were doing that made them special. It was how they were thinking about it, how they were thinking about the people. Like we were, you mentioned earlier, we do keynotes. Like we are so lucky. Like we get to speak to thousands of people every single month. And, you know, we ask them, well, what do you think of when you hear the word salesperson? And you get it, all of them, smarmy, manipulative, yucky, pushy. And you go, who's the greatest, that's our second question. Well, who's the greatest salesperson you know? My mom, my dad, my husband, my wife, Steve Jobs and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were the two most popular answers. Jesus has been, you know, a top five for quite some time. Like it is unbelievable the incongruence between like who we think salespeople are and who we think great salespeople are. And so that's sort of, you know, the crux of the answer.
Garrett, as a lawyer, you know, I don't see many salespeople coming out of law school with a natural sort of propensity to want to do anything except argue and argue well on behalf of the client they're serving. Where was that little thing for you which you thought, actually, I can talk well, I can logic well, I can put together an argument well. How do I transform that into sales? Like, what was that kernel for you?
You're giving me way too much credit. I don't think it was that thought out at the time. When I went to law school in the first place, it was not to be a lawyer. It's because I was in my 20s and I had no idea what I wanted to be when I grew up. Right. And I just figured that was a transferable skill. I looked at a lot of the people in the business areas that I was interested in and that I admired, and they had law degrees. So I thought, oh, this will be good. Unfortunately, if anybody knows anything about law school, you end up in this world of the most like type A competitive people on the planet. And I happen to be one of those. So when somebody gets a really good law job for the summer, I'm like, well, I can get a better law job for the summer. And I just ended up sort of practicing law by accident. But to your point, it was miserable for me in terms of just constantly being contentious. And I don't work that way. I don't like to be contentious. I like to make people happy and try to be positive. And that's just not the world that I found myself in. Also, let me be honest, I was a terrible lawyer, and it probably had to do with the fact that I hated it, but I sucked at it. So when you call me a lawyer, that's really giving me way too much credit. But I saw a couple things because I was representing startups, and I saw these people on this amazing journey that looked like a lot more fun than I was having. And I also noticed that the attorneys in the firm that I was working with, the ones that were making real money and that were having the most fun and not, you know, sitting there buried in papers all day, were the ones that were selling. They were bringing in the new clients. They were the rainmakers, they call them, you know? And so that kind of, those two things combined were like, okay, I got to get out of this. And when I did, the easiest place for me to get a foot in the door with the startup in the world that I wanted to be in was through a sales role. And then from there, I got really lucky because I was able to actually perform. And especially in a smaller company like a startup, that's when you're able to climb quickly. And that's when I was able to find my way and carve my path.
What do you guys love about teaching? Because before we jumped on here, you know, we all have taught and am teaching entrepreneurship to young people that are trying to work out, you know, do I go traditional career or do I go something else? And do I pave my own way? What do you guys love about teaching?
I'll give an example because it's too big of an answer. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about we at our last class of every semester, we let them in on the secret that we as the teachers receive just as much value like from them as they do from us.
Right.
And they never ever get that. Hmm. You know, like they don't really hear it like until they actually understand like what a relationship is. So I think for me, I'll leave it at a really high level. Like we get to teach. We don't have to. We get
I'm sure there are people here that are just listening to this and not watching it and didn't see our faces light up when you talk about teaching. But it truly, I mean, we do a lot of things together, individually. We do a ton of different things professionally. And the absolute most rewarding one is teaching, and always has been. It's our favorite 2 hours of the week for a whole bunch of reasons, not the least of which is that we get to like, when we created our class, we created the class that we wished we had when we were 20 years old. And we took all the lessons that we learned over, you know, 20 plus years each in the business world. And we're like, what are the ones that really have made a difference in our life? And we get to share those with people who maybe have never heard of a concept of a growth mindset or of optimism, you know, pathological optimism, the way that we teach it and things like that. So it's really special to do that for us. And then, you know, we just have so many students. We're really lucky that we get kind of the best of the best at USC. And a lot of these students have become friends and colleagues and So there's nothing better than of all the things we do than teaching.
I want to just double down on what Garrett just said. Can you imagine like teaching someone about the difference between goals and purpose for the first time? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because like as adults, like we don't learn this until, you know, we should be learning it earlier, but we don't really learn it until we're in the trenches and like our backs are against the wall and we need to figure out how to be resilient and gritty and purpose driven and, you know, have goals. Or like the concepts of scarcity versus abundance, like even if it's through the lens of how you view prospects, it's still the first time 80% of our students are hearing about the difference between how you view the world through an abundance or scarcity. Like, there's just so many big unlocks that like we get to have for the first time. And Garrett and I make this joke all the time. Like, hopefully we are beating them to their first boss who will either ruin them or change their lives for the better.
I love that. I love that. I have exactly the same feeling. I can't believe I get paid to do this, to be honest. And it's one of those things where I probably have 30% of the class. These are MBA candidates. So I have 30% of the class who never realized there was the option to go it themselves. And they never knew there was a tool set or a mindset. And it is extraordinary to see them come out the other side with a small side hustle that 2 or 3 years later has turned into a fully fledged company. It's a super cool thing to be part of, which I think is probably the perfect segue into this small publication called The Unsold Mindset. I'm keen for you to help the listeners understand what is the unsold mindset and why is it so important? Garrett, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. There, in any aspect of our lives, we kind of have this box that we think we're supposed to fit into. You know, as a parent, I'm supposed to do these things. As a professional, I'm supposed to do these things. And Colin and I have noticed over the years that this is especially true with salespeople. Like, especially young salespeople come into a job and they think they're supposed to sound a certain way. They're supposed to be really confident. They're supposed to have all the answers. They're supposed to, you know, overcome objections as soon as they come. And what we really realized as we started to have conversations with amazing people across a whole bunch of industries, and I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more, but as we had these conversations to write this book, we realized that all of the people who were great at what they do, they didn't care about the box that they were supposed to fit in. They were literally unsold on how they were supposed to do things and what their customers thought they were supposed to do. They gave themselves permission to do things their own way. So that's where the title of the book comes from and the big concepts of the book come from. And I think it's interesting, Colin, maybe we want to talk about kind of the book we started writing versus the book we ended up writing, because that also plays into it a little bit.
Yeah. We say this a lot because it's true. You can't change your world or anybody else's world if you don't know how to move people. Right? Like if the top two answers are Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Steve Jobs for the greatest salespeople, you know, on the planet, like then that there's something to be said about how important it is. This idea that if you are selling yourself, or if you are selling an idea, or if you're selling someone else's idea all the time, and that's not a yucky thing. Mm. Like, is The Unsold Mindset a book about selling authentically or living authentically? Right? And like these blurred lines are so important to call out, because when you think about like these great salespeople that exude this passion and they've got some it factor that you think, you know, you're just born with, like they care differently. Right? And they don't just care differently from 9 to 5. They care differently in life. Mm-hmm. You know, that was it. Like, so we interviewed Snoop and it was like, and I'll back up and tell you why we even were interviewing Snoop. But we interviewed Snoop and we were like, why is everyone telling us you're the greatest salesperson on the planet? And he's like, my mom told me a long time ago, do you, and everything else will take care of itself. And like the best part about The Unsold Mindset was that the interview process that we embarked on, everyone was doing the same thing. And none of them knew that they were doing it themselves, let alone that General Stanley McChrystal or Chef Roy Choi or Jeff Aroff were doing the exact same things.
Yeah.
You know, in a privileged position, like I said earlier, we get to label what they're already doing, and that, these are these big epiphanies that people are having. We had a huge epiphany early on in the book writing process, because we thought we were writing a book about what great sales professionals are doing different than everyone else. Like, we just wanted to know. And people really want to know that too, right? Entrepreneurs want to know how to be good at this thing called sales. Right. And when we went out to these great sales professionals at all of these big companies that everybody, you know, thinks if you're number one there, you could be number one anywhere. And we're like, hey, why are you so good? And who's the greatest salesperson you know that influenced you? And lo and behold, almost every single sales professional we talked to gave us the name of the greatest salesperson that influenced them. And none of them had sales in their title. Like, they were all entrepreneurs. They were doctors. They were lawyers. They were chefs. They were bartenders. They were rappers. They were heads of marketing. They were engineers. But none of them were like quote unquote sales professionals. And that's when we went to all of those people and we're like, hey, what are you doing that's so damn good? And yeah. Then it was like this clear pattern. They were all doing the same thing. And it wasn't what they were doing. It was how they were thinking about stuff.
I love that. And so when you think about the way in which people who hold those large sales roles, I mean, there are so many different titles that you can see on LinkedIn of people who are selling. Chief revenue officers, chief distribution folks, you know, chief. If we're all selling, what is it, what role are you looking for? If you can take your book and your teachings and move your way through an organization, what are the kinds of roles that people should be looking for if they've gone, you know what, I've learned this, I'm fully embracing what these guys are telling me. I'm in a very traditional organization. Let's just call it a software company. What is my path to have the greatest effect?
As you ask that question, are you thinking about somebody who is in sales, quote unquote, or are you talking about people in general who want to sell more no matter what they do?
Well, I think it's for people who are coming into sales who have not done it before, like formally, right? Or at least in what the structures would allow them to believe to be sales. Because people often see that the greatest upside and the greatest influence you can have in senior roles is where you're able to sell. Mm-hmm. And I think a number of people aren't really thinking about that until it's maybe too late in their career and they try to pivot across and they don't quite know how to make that work because they haven't built a muscle or muscles around that in their career. So what do you think people are looking for if they're trying to make that change? Gary, what do you think?
Well, we're lucky. We get, you know, going back to the teaching conversation, we get to talk to young people who are struggling with very similar questions all the time. Like every week we talk to people in our office hours who are like, going into their first job and what should I do? What role should I take? What industry should I go in? And I think my answer, as you asked that question, and it is an interesting question, but I think it doesn't matter. Because as we've been saying, there's sales in every single role that you're going to have, no matter whether you're a product manager or an engineer or a salesperson, you're going to be selling in some way, shape, or form. And so I think the more important question than what role should I take is, you know, where do I see myself going? And maybe not in 10 years, but maybe in like 3 years or 5 years. Like what is the path I want to take? And then take a role that's going to get you the skills and the knowledge and the relationships that you need for that role, your next role, or maybe even the role after that, as opposed to, I want to get good at selling, so I need to take this role or that role. I mean, one of the things that makes me cringe the most on the internet these days is the word should, because there's so many experts and gurus that they say you should do this and you should do that. But part of an unsold mindset is that there is absolutely no one right way to do things. So I hope this doesn't sound like a hedge answer, because I really do mean it. Like if you're interested in a certain industry or a certain role, but you also want to get that sales experience, you can take any role you want as long as it's sort of preparing you for where you want to go versus just, oh, this is the path for everyone.
I like that answer because Garrett and I sometimes have different answers, but we end up in the same place. Like I was going to give him some shears to trim that hedge, but the truth is I agree. But I think another way to put it is, no matter what role you want, you should understand the skill set of selling is extremely important to get to that role. Like, it's not a coincidence that some of the best CEOs and founders have roots in sales, but it's known, if you think about it, like, who do we give permission to sell? We give permission to CEOs and founders to sell to us, right? Like, we don't necessarily give permission to people that have sales in their titles too, but we'll give permission to engineers or introverts, right? Mm-hmm. Like there are certain people that should have the skill set, not of being the best version of a salesperson, but being the best version of themselves in a selling situation. Like that's where the flawed analysis of if everyone sells and I am an engineer and I have to sell an idea or a project is I'm going to show up and I'm going to be the best version of a salesperson, right? Who I think of to pitch this. The reality is, like, don't try to be the best version of someone else. Like, try to be the best version of you in the moment. Like, we'll give you more credit for being resourceful and going out and finding answers, and we'll give you credit for being a knower. Nobody wants to be in the room with a know-it-all, but most of us are being trained early on to know it all. So it's like, there are like these really interesting distinctions that if you just think about it, if you were just real, you know, if you as a mindset from a metacognition, like a talking to myself perspective, who people expect me to be and who people hope I am could potentially be two different people.
Right.
You know, and like at the end of the day, like I am making a decision on buying based on who I'd rather spend more time with, because all of you are selling commodities, or it's a commoditized sell no matter what. So if I'm making a decision on who I'd rather spend more time with, I would rather spend more time with someone that I can see myself in. Someone that's not perfect, because there's no such thing as perfect. And if you are too perfect, then we get that, and we say no to you because you're right. Like, we say no to you because you have the answer, which is the antithesis of what you thought you were supposed to be. So, you know, there's a lot there, but it's a good question, a complicated answer.
No, I like it. And so, you know, when we think about partnerships, of course, it's a pretty romantic term, right? You've got partners at home, you've got business partners. You've also got this idea of how companies grow. And my thesis is that the most sustainable way for an organization to grow in both directions, whether it be in product innovation, is to go back down into a supply chain and form really strong partnerships with those people, with the people who have, you know, built a widget and built a cog because they love that cog and they wanted to see it sort of live in a much larger machine and to have its time in the light. Right through to the way that you can sell and distribute whatever you've built through other people to make the value of whatever the distributor is even more pronounced. It feels as though the world not being in such a great shape right now, the partnership is probably the answer to many different problems that we have. When you think about, and this could be in anything, right? This could be in conflict. It could be in the way that we do healthcare. It could be the way that we support people who are less fortunate. It could also be in the way that we sell Apple devices, right? But one way or the other, partnerships seem to play a pretty pivotal role in reaching people that as one organization, you can't do by yourself. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, when people are trying to think about how they would enter a new partnership, and we're talking sort of in a organization to organization context, that values-driven mentality and, you know, Colin, as you said before, being yourself to create a narrative where somebody says, you know, I would be happy to do business with you, not because of what you're selling, but because of who you are and what you represent and what you're trying to achieve. How would you take the unsold mindset and help people trying to think about partnerships close out more of those really important partnerships? Because when I mean, a lot of my work, people feel afraid to have those conversations, to say, actually, we once thought that we could do it all ourselves. And the market is very quickly telling us we can't do it all ourselves. So, Colin, let's start with you. How should somebody take the principles that you guys have cultivated and put that into a B2B kind of development mindset?
I stole a quote from Garrett a long time ago. It's from a Hall of Famer football player named Ray Lewis, American football. Mm-hmm. And he said, which is primarily played on Sundays, even though now it's played every day. Sure. And he said, the team, they pay me for what I do Monday to Saturday, but Sundays are free. Like, Sundays are my pleasure. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that is such an anchor theme for the Unsold Mindset when it comes to partnerships, because essentially he's saying that he loves the game so much that he would play it on Sunday. They got to pay him for the bodily injury, the harm, the diet. But you think about that, like with two people who wake up every single morning and they get to do their Sunday moments. And what if they had different Sunday moments? You know, like Garrett and I, we are passionate about a lot of the same things. And what we're good at and what we're passionate about aren't always the same thing. But when they converge, like inside of you, that's special. But the next best thing is like if you have a partnership where they converge. And we've done so many interviews on this in the book. We call it intentional ignorance. But it's just this idea of, if you know what you love so much that you would basically do it for free, like it authentically gives you energy, you also know what you don't love so much, right? Like when you're encroaching on somebody else's dharma. You know, we interviewed this the best interview in a long time, recent, this woman, and it was like, hey, what's your Sunday moment? She works for a large company. Like, what's your Sunday moment? She said, I love creating collateral. Like, just give me a room by myself and let me just create. And I looked at her like she was crazy. I was like, you mean like PowerPoint presentations? And she was like, oh, yes, I love create, right? And in contrast, you got to pay me a boatload of money to create PowerPoint presentations. I'm not good at it. And it doesn't authentically give me energy, but it does for her. And I go, okay, well what is the company paying you a lot of money for? Right? Like, what is it you have to do? You don't love doing. And she's like, these damn meetings. I can't stand them. Like, it sucks energy out of me to have a conversation with like four people in a given day. Meanwhile, she's talking to someone that would talk to people for free all day long. Mm-hmm. Like, imagine if me and her were on the same team, and every day she woke up and got to do what she loved. And you know, I see a lot of that in Garrett and I, and I'll shut up, because when you're a partner, you know when to shut up when your partner's looking.
Well, I actually love that. I'm going to take a little bit of a different angle to the answer, and I'll talk about kind of the when you're thinking about partnerships and looking at them, the intent matters. What is your intention with this partnership? Mm-hmm. And what I mean, and a great example, there's a chapter in our book that where we talk about the difference between transactional interactions and transformational interactions. And, you know, if you're coming in and you're thinking, I need to partner up with somebody so that I can do this or so that I can grow my business for that, and you're thinking of it very transactionally, like I'm going to give them this, they're going to give me a little bit more, and I'm going to come out ahead. You know, that generally is not the way to approach a partnership of any kind. Yeah. Whereas if you come in thinking transformationally, how do I transform this person, their world, their business, this relationship, whatever, those are the partnerships that tend to last. And they're the ones that tend to be more meaningful and the ones that ultimately end up being more valuable financially or otherwise. So I would encourage people as they think about partnerships, like, how can you be more transformational? And we've got some exercise. And one exercise that we give in the book was a company we were working with, and their sales team was kind of flatlining a little bit. They weren't hitting their numbers. And we realized really quickly looking into it that most of the salespeople were just constantly being transactional, taking and taking time and trying to get money. And so what we had them do is we had them print out all of their, any sales communications they had. So their scripts, their email campaigns, all of that stuff. And we had them then list out underneath each one of those things, what are you giving and what are you taking? And so they could see, oh, I'm asking this person for a 15-minute phone call here. I'm asking them for money here. I'm asking them to respond to this questionnaire there. And eventually we shifted it and we said, okay, for every time you give, make sure, or every time you get ask for something, make sure you're giving more in return. And it just completely shifted the way that they were communicating with their customers and their partners. And so that's just one kind of, I just wanted to give one kind of concrete example of that. But overall, thinking transformationally versus transactionally is huge when it comes to partnerships.
Yeah, I love that. Let's turn to vulnerability then. So, you know, being yourself can be good for a lot of people. It can be frightening for others, right? And when we're trying to be vulnerable in a sale and we're trying to not overstep a mark, you know, mm-hmm. we've been told what we can give away. We know what we can't. But in the moment, there can be almost a time where you say, actually, it's worth giving more away and being generous early in order to build and collapse that time to trust so you can move to the next step and create value, because without that stage, nothing's going to start. So when you think about, Garrett, you know, vulnerability in sales, how can leaders use vulnerability apply vulnerability so that it can strengthen a relationship as opposed to maybe losing credibility? And I have a funny feeling in asking that question, it might not be a zero-sum game. There's probably
it probably isn't. It's like my previous answer that Colin accused me of hedging on, which is that it is going to be different for different people. And that's fair. But I mean, that's Colin being vulnerable is going to look very different than me being vulnerable. And it's going to, like, something that he is comfortable saying or doing in an interaction with somebody might make me really uncomfortable. So there's a rule that we always teach our students, and we say it in various ways, but we usually start out by saying, you know, if you think you sound cheesy, you're probably right. You do sound cheesy. Or if you think you sound pushy, you're right. You sound pushy. Or if you think you're being a little bit too vulnerable too soon, you're probably right. And that's just self-awareness. And again, mm-hmm. it's different for different people, but ultimately it comes back to that authenticity that we talk about so much, kind of the overarching theme of all of this, because as long as you're doing what's comfortable to you, people are going to respond to that and understand that. So giving yourself permission to be vulnerable, might look different for different people. I'll also say, because I think one thing you're kind of dancing around is, are there boundaries to it? Can you be too vulnerable? And I think the answer is definitely yes. And a great example of that, when we were interviewing Ari Melber for our book, he's a news anchor here in the US, and he is kind of known for like quoting hip hop and rap lyrics in his newscasts, which is not a common, typical thing for a mm-hmm. newscaster to do. But he's, you know, it's something that he's passionate about, and he's able to work it in appropriate times. And we were talking to him about authenticity, because that's a very authentic and even you could say vulnerable thing to do, to put yourself out there in a way that people aren't expecting. And he said, you know, if I was being my most authentic self, I would go to work wearing jeans and a hoodie every day and then read the news in jeans and a hoodie. He's like, I can't do that because people won't take me seriously. He said, there are boundaries to the level of authenticity that I am allowed to express. And that's okay. We have to be aware of those things and realistic about them. And I think that same litmus test applies to vulnerability as well. They're kind of cousins, right? Vulnerability and authenticity. They're not that far apart. So I would say there absolutely are boundaries. They're going to be different for different people, but it's worth thinking about.
Colin, anything to add to that?
Channeling my inner Garrett and looking at the clock. I think a really good example to drive it home is during lockdown, COVID lockdown, like we were writing this book, like mm-hmm. we were deep in interviews, and that was great for us because we got access to a lot of tape, you know, that we would have never had because everybody was on tape. And so, during lockdown, we saw so many underperforming salespeople thrive during lockdown in different verticals. Mm-hmm. And we weren't really sure why, because they didn't have much in common other than they were either on pips or not doing well before lockdown. And then for some strange reason, they were at the top of the leaderboard and getting fat commission checks when it was lockdown. So something changed. And it wasn't until you go back and you look at the tape and you just see the pattern emerge. And it's so obvious, like the first, whatever, like call it 4 minutes of every Zoom call or whatever interaction they were on, whatever platform they were using, sounded something like a bumbling idiot on the salesperson side. You know, like it was this, like there'd be these apologies. They'd be like, I thank you for showing up today for the demo. Like, I don't even know if we should be having this conversation right now. Like, this is really weird. And that's my wife, like chasing my 3-year-old, trying to put an adult mask on him. And normally we don't have laundry in the background, but normally you don't see my background. This is before we knew how to blur the backgrounds. You know what I mean? Like, it was like, you would just watch these people be like ridiculously vulnerable. And then eventually they cut themselves off because they would realize that they sound like they're bumbling idiots. And they'd go, anyways, I'm sorry. I just wanted to just say that, like, I want to call the elephant out in the room. But almost every time the reaction on the other end of the Zoom was big breath. I'm so happy you said that.
Yeah.
This shit is so weird.
Mm-hmm.
Quote unquote, this is my first pandemic too. Quote unquote, I haven't even met my coworkers. I got this job 2 weeks ago and then the world shut down. Like, you have never seen a salesperson and a prospect get on the same page in the first minute. Like, I had never seen it before, to the point where, like, at some point 4 minutes in, you're watching the prospects ask the salespeople to start selling them. Like, all right, well, let's get down to this demo so that we keep the jobs that we're complaining about, which is beautiful because that means that, like, you're adding value as a salesperson, or I wouldn't be here. Like, there's this, the point of that, speaking of jumbling idiots, the point is that if you look at it for what it's worth, what that was it was just a microcosm of why the unsold are great. Mm-hmm. It's because those people knew during COVID, they were definitely living through a shared experience. They had no problem showing that part of them because they knew that the people on the other side were going through the same hard time. So if we all knew that, right? If we all were like, I'm living a shared experience with this person on the other side of the screen, like, let me just be vulnerable enough for them to know it. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that was just driving the point home.
You know what? It's that happened so many times. We had to move our team, and I'm a scientist by training, our company, that I retired from, we had a very scientific heavy group, which was all working in labs. We, you know, had all these protocols to move in and out of labs, and masks were the least of our problems. There was so much we had to do, and the exhaustion that you would see from people on the other end of a Zoom call, you know, you could hear kids in the background. You could hear, it just oozed out of people. And more often than not, when I was doing deals overseas, who had been in lockdown a lot longer than we had been here. And we didn't have it too bad here. I mean, we were still locked down, but maybe not as bad as say Italy, for example, or other parts of France, which were just, and in the UK, just catastrophic, right? You would have these conversations where they were just relieved to talk about anything that didn't involve the four walls they were sitting inside of. Yes, yeah. And it just, it collapsed the time to relationship in such a profound way that most of those people who we didn't do deals with are still colleagues because we just catch up because we had that shared experience. So I think it's hugely important. And I'm curious, and I know we're going to get cut of time soon, but I'm curious, what do we do now that we don't have that shared experience?
We do have that shared experience.
Talk more about that. Point,
right? Like we were just at Microsoft. We love Microsoft, right? We get to spend like a good amount of time there. They're such learners. You know, like when you go to a room, you don't know if you got a room full of knowers or a room full of learners, but like they got a room full of learners. And like we're talking to them and want something that Microsoft is obviously leading the front on right now is AI. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking to not necessarily salespeople, but people that have to communicate with others that could be scared of AI, mm-hmm. right? That could fear AI, that could not really understand it. Like, and this conversation around a shared experience was so relevant because we're all living through whatever's happening right now with society and AI. We all know just as much as we all know, and then we all don't know just as much as we don't know. And mm-hmm. you can either lean into that, right? And have these like vulnerable moments with people where they will give you credit for what you don't know, just as much as give you credit for what you do know. And I think that, you know, if it wasn't AI, it would be having kids.
It's not the AI experience. It's the human experience.
It's the human experience.
Right.
We're all going through the same stuff in our own way. And it's so, you know, Colin will often, when he's coaching up young salespeople, he'll often say, you know, your goal as a salesperson is to get the other person to see themselves in you as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's really not that hard to do. You know, Colin's given some examples, but we talk about show your work in our book. And it's, you know, like in math class back in high school, when you didn't just get credit for the answer, but you had to show all the steps that you got there.
Yeah.
You know, people give you credit for that in real life too. And so, you know, we'll have students come in and they'll be stressed out about a meeting that they got with a VC or something because they're going to raise money. And like, I don't want the VC to think I'm just a college kid who doesn't know what they're doing and who's wasting their time. And our advice is always the same. We say, tell them that right at the beginning of the call. Go, I've been so excited about this call, but I'm also nervous because I don't want you to see me as just a college student who's going to waste your time and, you know, whatever. Tell that story, show that work.
Yep.
And always the other person's going to see something in themselves there. Like, yeah, when I was a college kid, I felt the same way. Or, you know, I have these conversations all the time. Whatever it is, you can get to that point where you're having a shared experience very quickly, pandemic or no pandemic, AI or no AI.
The sad part is that people like buying from people like themselves. So what Garrett's really talking about here is if everybody likes buying from people like themselves, how do you show someone that does not see themselves in you, that you are a lot more alike than you think? Mm-hmm. And that's just basically getting to the common denominator. No matter what, how different we are, the one thing we have in common is we're both imperfect, right? So like all I have to do is just make sure that you see that in me. I was like my fiance back in the day, now my wife, like she was a heavy wedding planner. Heavy wedding planner. She put like meetings in between my work meetings and I would show up late to meetings, like work meetings. I'm like, I'm so sorry. I've got this fiance and wedding planning season and it's crazy. And anyways, I'm sorry. I should have been on time. And you know, the responses were always out of such a place of love. Like you knew that they saw themselves in me just because I gave myself permission to show a piece of me that they weren't expecting. They'd be like, hey, Kyle, don't worry about it. It's going to be way easier on your second marriage. I'm not losing that deal. Hey, Colin, don't worry about it. Been married for 30 years. Happy wife, happy life. Like, that's my deal. If someone mm-hmm. is being vulnerable enough to tell me about their marital history in the first 5 seconds, like, that's a vibe that I caught. And it wasn't on purpose. It was, let me just show you who I am so that you can see yourself in me, even if we do not look alike.
Love that. We have a 5-question rapid fire that we're going to get to in just a second. And I hope you're ready for it. Because it usually makes people think a little bit differently about life. But before we get to that, Ryan Hawke talks about having a failure recovery system when things don't go so well. And he's talking from a from an American football point of view, where there is a physical motion that you make to snap yourself out of a point of failure so you can just reset and move on to the next play. You both talk about failure, and you know, when we talk about sales or putting ourselves out there in life anywhere, failure is inevitable to come our way, and it's really how we think, process, and deal with it afterwards. How do you think about how leaders can process failure so that they can continue moving and being in motion on the things they need to do? Because obviously in sales, not everyone is going to say yes. Not every deal is going to get closed. Colin, how do you help people understand the richness of failure, which ultimately on the flip side of that coin is just another lesson to be learned?
Yeah. You know, Garrett fails a lot, so he's probably the best person to...
It's not wrong.
We fail equally, just to be clear.
Looking up at this guy is my greatest failure.
Exactly. We advocate a lot for celebrating the process. You know, like, we don't have enough time to really go into it, but we've done so much work with such great companies that have figured out how to create an infrastructure where people celebrate, like, getting no's, celebrate getting, like, there was a company that had a hangout where, like, every week you would get a spiff for whoever got basically the best objection, right? The best hang up, the best no. The idea that you're going to get, you know, if you're a 30% closer, it means that 7 out of 10 times someone is not being nice to you. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't have your happiness predicated on when you win, unless winning looks different, right? So, like, you have to be celebrating mile markers, not just finish lines. Right. And we found that the greatest salespeople on the planet, every leader we talked to that was just absolutely incredible, they all had this, like, purpose-driven finish line. Mm-hmm. You know, they almost manufactured it. Like, they weren't going to be able to catch it. Right? They're using words like serving and inspiring and teaching and giving. You don't wake up one day and say, you got it. And so because of that, everything backwards, like, they could just clearly make decisions like, is what I'm doing moving me closer or further away from my purpose? Mm-hmm. Right. And the goals didn't look like they were just finish lines. And then you got to the other side of it and you were like, damn, I thought this was going to feel different. The same thing for the rejections, right? Like, when you got to the rejection, when you got to the no, like, it wasn't like it broke you down. It was like, okay, why is this good? Because I'm going to get the same thing tomorrow. And now I've got this tool belt. You know, Garrett and I say, we hope you get 1,000 no's in your first, you know, 30 days. Mm-hmm. Because now you got, if you did it right and you were like, hey, what could I have done differently? Now you've got 1,000 tools. You get it.
Perfect. Yeah, that's it. Garrett, anything to add?
I have nothing to add. As usual, Colin has summed up, you celebrate the process. If you learn how to do that, then you're going to view failures differently and you're going to be playing a game of prolonged gratification instead of a game of delayed gratification.
Mm-hmm. We're going to go to the 5 question rapid fire now. And Garrett, before we do, where can people learn more about you both, this wonderful book and the resources that you have? How can people reach you?
Well, The Unsold Mindset is available anywhere books are sold. And we are very easy to find on social media at Colin and Garrett on Twitter and Instagram. We're at ourselves on LinkedIn. We'd love to hear from people. And our website is colinandgarrett.com. Has more info than you'll ever want to know about my pal here. you know, we're easy to find, and we love when we hear from folks who heard us on podcasts. So if anyone listening to this or watching this has questions, wants to dig in a little deeper on something, please reach out. Don't hesitate. We're here for you.
Amazing. All right, let's get into it. Colin, I'm going to get your answer first, and then Garrett, you can go second. So let's dive in. Question number one, partnership is, complete that sentence.
A relationship.
Garrett, partnership is?
Having each other's back.
Question two, what content are you loving at the moment?
The Unsold Mindset.
I mean, it's great content. Don't get me wrong.
That's my answer. You said rapid fire.
Come on.
Well, what content am I loving right now? I am loving, Garrett, go first. Let me think.
You know, this isn't going to be helpful from a partnership or a business. Well, maybe it is, because I would love to, one of my other favorite places to be besides in the classroom is on the couch next to my wife watching movies and television. Mm-hmm. And we've been revisiting a lot of our favorite movies from the 90s. And that is what is, I look forward to, like, oh, Friday night's coming up. Lauren and I are going to be watching a 90s movie. And that is what I'm enjoying right now. It's good for the soul and good for the relationship.
Yeah.
I just finished Charles Duhigg's book. That's what I'll say.
Okay. Excellent. Well, we just finished for the third time, The West Wing, end to end. So nice. Felt like we needed something like that in the world right now. Okay. Question number three. What's the worst piece of advice you've received and why, Colin?
Do what I tell you. No, what is it? Do what I tell you, not what I do.
Do as I say.
Do as I say, not what I do.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty bad advice. Garrett?
You know, my thinking on this has changed lately. I don't know that somebody specifically gave me this advice, but like Collins, it's one of those adages that you hear, that the old fake it till you make it. I used to think that was true. And I do think there's something to acting as if you are where you want to be. But that feels very different to me. The way people interpret fake it till you make it, especially on the internet these days, is really frustrating, because there's a lot of snake oil out there. And I don't think that's the best way to learn and to grow and to build a business or a brand or anything like that. I think you got to go out and do things first. And so that's where I'll go with that.
Amazing. All right. Question four. When you see potential for a new partnership, what's the first thing you do to turn potential into action?
Ask questions I actually want to know the answers to.
Fall in love. And for those cringing or wondering what I'm talking about, you're going to have to check out The Unsold Mindset, Chapter 3.
Well played. I like that. All right. Last question.
It wasn't on purpose, but
I think that was a great answer. I feel like you may have given that answer before. Question five, what's the one thing you're deeply grateful for right now, Colin?
Garrett Brown.
Ah. Well, now I'm going to sound like a jerk when I say my kids.
You are a jerk. See The Unsold Mindset introductions.
That is amazing. Colin, Garrett, it has been such a pleasure to catch up with you today. I feel like we've got work to do in the future together. So thank you for making the time, and thank you for putting those resources into the world, because I think they make a massive difference. We'll be linking to all of that in the show notes. But until next time, guys, thanks for your time today.
This was great. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to the end of this episode of Partnership Plus. If you like what you heard, you can share this episode via text message. And if you'd like to build your business partnership muscle, my free weekly newsletter called Wednesday Partnership will help you do just that. You'll find a link in the show notes. Finally, I'm big on encouragement and love to see people be in motion towards their ambitions. So if you know someone who might be struggling, reach out to them with a quick message of encouragement. It could change their life. Thanks again, and I'll see you in the next episode.